like I'm cracking the whip here. Okay, so now we're going to go till Bob 12:50 is the, just to give you a time frame there.
I'm going to turn over cross-examination to Hillary Lister.
Okay. All right. Okay, just begin here. First question is for Christine Cinnamon. Earlier you stated there were no Canadian issues.
Hey, Hillary?
Yes.
Can you speak up a little louder?
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. For Christine Cinnamon, earlier you stated there were no Canadian issues. I just wanted to ask, are you aware of the border trail? I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, Sentier Frontalis, which comes in close proximity to the proposed turbines?
I am.
Have you heard any concern from representatives or people working with that group on the impact of hikers on that trail at all?
Not directly. No, I have not.
All right. And also, in your assessment of impacts on wildlife, did you consider at all the effects of electromagnetic fields on wildlife?
Not with respect to wildlife in Canada, no.
Okay. Or in the U.S.?
We have previously addressed the topic of electromagnetic frequencies, both on the Kibbe project and other projects that I've worked on, and I am familiar with the topic. Familiar with the recent documentation that this is not an issue that rises to any significance, and therefore it did not need to be assessed in great detail related to this project.
So it was not assessed, was it assessed at all in this specific situation?
No, it was not.
Okay. Now, a few questions for Jeff Seltzer. Have you testified at hearings in favor of changing the CLUP over the past few years?
I have presented testimony on my own behalf in connection with the process of amending the CLUP.
What sort of changes were you advocating at that time?
Well, I have not been advocating for changes in the CLUP. I made comments relative to the staff drafts in the 2010 CLUP revision process.
And in that process, were you employed by landowners who have interest in the CLUP in the unorganized territories?
No, in that process, I was acting entirely in my own capacity, on my own time, and at my own expense.
All right. And would you agree that the CLUP is designed to provide long-term planning for the unorganized territories?
Yeah, the purpose of a comprehensive land use plan is to plan comprehensively for a land base. Yes, that's correct.
All right. And if TransCanada enters into an agreement with LURC and the people of Maine in this new plan, what guarantee do we have that the terms will not change at a later point?
I'm not sure I understand your question. In terms of an agreement, do you mean a binding legal agreement or a permit that's issued by the commission or?
Statements for the terms of the permit, yes.
So
do we have a guarantee that TransCanada will not come back at a later point seeking changes?
Are you talking about, do we have a guarantee that TransCanada will not seek an amendment to its permits?
That or other changes such as with changes to the conservation easement in the first Roach Plum Creek deal, just any sort of changes that might...
Right. You have to look at legal requirements sort of individually. You mentioned the conservation easement. A conservation easement has many parties, and in particular the Plum Creek easement has a significant number of parties. So TransCanada has no ability, they are not a party to that agreement, so they have no ability to change the terms of that agreement. That agreement can only be changed, that particular conservation easement can only be changed by the holder of the easement,
okay, I understand that.
The other parties of the easement, and state approval.
Okay. Sorry, I understand different example. Okay, would you describe this project as a larger scale than what has historically occurred in this area for impact?
Its scale is consistent with the existing Kibbe project that was permitted 2 years ago. I mean, if you're talking about over 1,000 years, I'm not...
Or just that this is expanding a project that is of a larger scale than historical uses in this area.
This is expanding a project approved 2 years ago that was different in nature than existing uses. The area, as Mr. Hudson has testified, was heavily cut over. It's been an industrial forest for well over 100 years. It's in an area that has been fairly aggressively harvested as an industrial forest. So we're talking about different types of impacts, but as I said in my testimony, every use that we make of the land has impacts on the land.
Okay. And would you agree that the greater the scale of development can result in a greater impact on the land?
Again, an assessment of that standpoint from a regulatory position, you know, that my testimony is limited specifically to the regulatory environment. From a regulatory standpoint, the commission's job is to look at each and every application before it and weigh the impacts of that application against the specific land base and natural resources that are affected.
All right. Thanks. Questions for Toby Williamson? Now, has your role in this project been as a planner or as a public relations representative? What specifically have you been employed to do in this project?
I've been employed to spend time in this area talking to the local people about their opinions of wind power and to work with them on their questions about the project and to help TransCanada understand what that context is.
And you work for a public relations firm, though, is that correct?
I work for Barton & Gingold. We're a communications management firm. And right. I have a background in planning, regional planning.
Okay. You state that there were a, quote, rare few who object to this project. Could you briefly describe how you encountered these people and what you heard from these rare few?
Sure. I mean, there's some people that are opposed to change of any kind, I would say. There's some people that just don't like the look of turbines. And I come across these people in town. At various meetings, times that I make presentations about the project.
Did you do a community survey of any sort?
No.
All right. Let's see. Have you testified at public hearings in favor of TransCanada's plans in this area?
I spoke during the last Kibbe, the original Kibbe project.
Okay. And have you made an effort to ensure that other proponents of the plan spoke at those hearings?
Well, I certainly speak with local people, and you know, there's a lot of people that support this project, and absolutely, there's times that I've asked them to come and say things. Okay. I've never put words in anyone's mouth, and I certainly encourage anybody that has anything to say about this project to come and speak about it to the commissioners.
Do you agree that there's already a local economy existing in this area that depends on the health of the fish and wildlife in the region?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Do you agree that there's already a local economy existing in this area in terms of hunting, fishing, camping, trapping that depends on the health of the fish and wildlife in this region?
Sure.
Right. Do you agree that people come from both sides of this border for those reasons?
Sure.
All right. Let's see. And in determining community support, did you communicate with people who live in the Chain of Ponds area, or was it primarily Eustis and Stratton?
No, I spoke with everybody that lives along the Chain of Ponds that would return my phone calls or meet with me, absolutely.
Okay. Have you communicated with wilderness guides in the area?
Not extensively, no. Okay. Let me clarify. How do you define a wilderness guide? I mean, I've spoken with people that are registered Maine guides. Does
registered
that count?
Maine guides, wilderness guides.
Sure. Then yes, I've spoken to some of them.
Okay. And have any of them raised concerns about the impact on this area?
Not directly to me, no.
Would you say there are very old trails in the area?
Sure. The route that the the Arnold expedition took was a route that the Native Americans used for centuries.
And would you say they used that for hunting and fishing as well?
Sure.
All right. Have any measures been taken to ensure the safety of people on foot or snowmobiles in the area to ensure they wouldn't be threatened from ice throw from the turbines?
Yes. There's an access policy that encourages people to stay safe distance from the turbines.
What is that distance?
I'd say roughly 1,000 feet.
Okay. And if a person is injured in proximity of a turbine, can a life flight helicopter reach that person?
I believe that there's access up there for helicopters to land, absolutely.
Even in close proximity to turbines? Because I know in other areas that has been limited.
There's definitely places helicopters could land.
Okay. And do local fire departments have the equipment and training to battle potential turbine fires and prevent the spread of forest fires from that?
That's not anything that I've discussed with them, but I'm...
Okay. I guess this is for any of the TransCanada representatives. Has that issue been addressed?
Hi, I'm Greg Shelton. You know, the Eustis Stratton Fire Department has taken part during the Kibbe Project in multiple hands-on exercises, both high angle and low angle. You know, we've worked with them closely throughout the project, and we'll continue to work with them, you know, throughout the life of Kibbe and possibly the Kibbe expansion. We do have designated life flight areas that people can be picked up. You know, in our equipment on the site, we have rescue sleds. We have, you know, the necessary equipment, if needed, to assist the local folks in getting people off.
Thank you. Back to Toby. Now, following the 2008 mudslide, did you hear concerns of the effect of erosion on local fisheries or any other concerns about that mudslide from people you were communicating with?
People in the local area were not concerned about it, and it had no impact on fisheries. That's my understanding. There's other people that are more appropriately, you know, able to answer the question, the details of that incident.
All right. And you stated the project has just begun to do its work mitigating climate change. Now, were you involved, or do you know how the impact on climate change from the project was quantified in the first place in order to determine this mitigation?
Sure. It was based on the megawatt hours that were estimated for the project.
Okay. And was the loss of carbon sequestration due to the loss of trees considered in the impact of the project at all?
It was not, but I...
Okay. Was the impact of the construction of the turbines or the construction equipment up there considered?
It was a, you know, we took the numbers from the megawatt hours and related that to how much that
so
would
that
reduce, you know, other generation facilities.
Okay, thanks. Now Peter Vickery. You just get, in terms of the impact of noise from the turbines on birds in the area, are you aware of the recent study that was cited by Diane Burritos in her pre-filed testimony concerning the impact of noise on wildlife?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, that study, it's in the pre-filed testimony. It's from the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution. It's pretty recent. It showed that the noise level as low as 10 decibels can have major impact.
Madam Chair, if she's going to be relying on a study, I ask that you provide a copy to the witness and also to counsel, particularly if she's going to be characterizing what it is the study concludes or says.
Can we have a copy here, I think? And this is in the pre-filed testimony as well. Just for the interest of time, I'm just going to continue explaining it. The noise as low as 10 decibels can have major impacts on wildlife by reducing the listening area by 90%. And that listening area is necessary for animals to communicate with each other for purposes of mating, sensing danger, and other necessary communication. Now, according to the Trans-Canada noise contour map in the back, there's a large region surrounding the turbines that shows a noise level of 30 decibels from the turbines. Was that area, first, was that considered in your assessments of noise, and do you know the acreage of that area?
Hang on just a half a sec, if that's all right. Yeah, what I'd really like is actually the reference thing. Is this the article you're talking about?
That looks, Diane.
The Acoustic Ecology Institute.
I'm not sure.
Which is not Trends?
That's not what I recognize as the... I was looking at Diane Burrito's pre-filed testimony reference. Or is that the study that goes with your pre-filed testimony? Okay. Yes.
So I just wanted to point out that this isn't a refereed citation. This is some sort of a summary. So I'm really not eager to comment on that.
Okay, we can pass on that right now. Well, a general question for TransCanada representatives here. In that map in the back showing the noise impacts, the 30 decibel range, does anyone know offhand what the acreage is of that region?
I don't have, it's Christine Cinnamon. I don't have that exact acreage. I mean, we could calculate it, but I would like to point out that when a wind turbine is producing that noise, the wind is also blowing, and you'd have to factor that into the noise levels.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks. Questions for Terry Bennett? So I think it came up earlier. Is this project slated to receive federal stimulus funding?
If we can start construction this year, we will apply for federal stimulus funding.
So is that funding dependent on approval of this plan now?
It's dependent on the timing of the start of construction.
And what's the deadline for that?
At the end of this year.
All right. And let's see. Now, during the hearings on rulemaking, TransCanada representatives had testified they requested an expansion that they didn't mention earlier because they didn't know at the time of opportunities to put turbines on CISC. And we had the same sort of issue with TransCanada deciding to pursue the TIF due to opportunities that they didn't know they'd previously have. What guarantee do we have that TransCanada will not seek more changes that might be contrary to statements made in these hearings?
What changes are you referring to?
I'm a little bit confused by the question. If you have specific prior testimony that you're asking him to look at,
I'm just referring to statements made in prior hearings about plans from TransCanada that then changed at a later point due to TransCanada finding out about, quote, opportunities that they were not aware of at the time.
Can you be more specific about the testimony that we had?
I don't have that right now, so Bob, do you?
Hearing that took place on the rulemaking, TransCanada's attorney explained to the commissioners that TransCanada was not aware of the opportunity to put an expansion project on Sis Mountain, and that's why they needed to have the expansion of the expedited area, and we are referring to that.
Since it's a statement I apparently made, could I clarify? The statement was in response to a question to TransCanada about future expansion plans during the Kibbe hearings. TransCanada testified at that time they didn't have future expansion plans, and the opportunity, and talking about the petition, the opportunity to develop CISC was not available to TransCanada when the Kibbe project was being permitted.
Yes, precisely. That's why we're asking the question. What guarantee of anything that you say here will be followed through?
And Amy Mills from the AG's office. I think the objection you're drawing from TransCanada is that it's a very broadly worded question. If there's a specific representation that's been made that you can specifically ask them about as to whether or not they anticipate seeking an alteration to that information or position that they've taken today, I think that they'd be able to answer the question.
All right. I'll skip that for now. I'm not sure if you'd be able to answer this or someone from TransCanada, but how viable is the data from the Met Tower that blew over this winter?
Can you repeat the question? Tom Patterson with TransCanada.
Thanks. I was just wondering, how viable is the data that we received from the Met Tower that blew over this winter?
Viable in what context?
Viable in terms of being able to provide a usable example of what the actual impact of these turbines, of the weather up there, seeing as it was only operational for a shortened period of time than what was originally intended.
We are measuring the wind at this point. We've had the original Met Tower installed since late September of 2009. And subsequent to that, it did fall early this year, and we have reinstalled that, and we are relying on correlations that we expect to establish between that data and the data collected on our Kibbe site.
Okay. And is that indicative at all of weather damage on turbines or towers? Is this something that we could expect again? Or
Met towers are temporary structures, and they're not we're talking completely different structures as compared to wind turbines.
All right. Back to Bennett. In your testimony, you state during the development and permitting of the original project, there was considerable focus on the fragile mountain environment in which roads and turbines would be erected. TransCanada implemented specialized construction techniques to ensure that the underlying hydrology of the area would be maintained and stormwater would be properly managed. My question is, how was the October 2008 mudslide able to occur in spite of this effort, and what's changed since then?
I think that's better directed towards the technical folks on our team.
Have you been sworn in? You all have? Okay.
Newhoff, could you please repeat the question?
Yes, sir. There's the statement that in the original implementation of this project, TransCanada implemented specialized construction techniques to ensure that the underlying hydrology of the area would be maintained and stormwater would be properly managed. Yet, in spite of that, there was the major mudslide in 2008. I'm just wondering how that was able to occur in spite of this effort and what has changed since then.
On a project of this nature, there will be inevitably occasions where measures which are in place will fail. We had an incident. We learned from the incident. No permanent damage occurred. The area was restored. Revegetation is taking place. And that's all I can say.
All right. And finally, questions for Christine Simmons regarding vernal pools. Now, what protocol specifically did you follow for surveying the vernal pools?
I can just answer generally, as per my testimony this morning, that we followed the protocol by IF&W to identify potential vernal pools outside of the typical spring season. That is a standard protocol, and I'll pass it over to Dana Valu, who is the expert on this.
If I could just continue my question first. Isn't it true that the protocol for certifying vernal pools is during the designated egg-laying season when egg masses of salamanders and wood frogs are present?
I'll pass it over to Dana to answer that question.
So that is correct, that in order to certify a vernal pool as significant, you need to do it during the accepted window. However, IF&W has recognized that not every survey can take place during that window. And in those cases, what is accepted written guidance from IF&W is that you identify potential areas, apply 250-foot buffer habitat areas to those areas as if they were significant, and assess the impacts of those buffer areas. And in this case, we've done that, and all of the existing plus proposed development within those buffer areas falls below the threshold that requires any sort of mitigation to those buffer areas. So we're below, and it's a 25% total disturbed area within those 250-foot buffers.
And is it true that you'd been doing field work in the winter, though?
No, that's not necessarily true. We started our soil survey work and wetland survey work in June, which was largely wrapped up by August. However, due to changes in layout, through consultation with agency folks, and also reviewing field data, we did have to do some additional survey in areas that we had not surveyed originally.
How far in advance did you know the surveys for vernal pools would need to be done?
How far in advance did we know? The project planning was in its very early stages in the spring of that year. So, and it was before the vernal pool window. And I did have communication with folks on the Kibbe site as to when the snowpack was going to leave the site, and therefore amphibian breeding would be taking place. And fact of the matter is, when the snowpack went, we went to look, and we found tadpoles in potential vernal pool area. So what that means to me is we missed the window.
And
so that's simply the case. We just missed the window. So then we applied the IF&W guidance for when you miss the window.
So isn't it true that the Met Tower studies were submitted in March?
Which Met Tower studies are you referring to?
The Met Tower application for CISC.
I'm not sure what's...
If I could clarify that question. The original application for a Met Tower on CISC, which began in March, would have been before the window of opportunity to do a full, complete vernal pool study.
Well, we did field surveys for siting a Met Tower outside of that the survey window, correct? That's correct. But we weren't looking at the entire site. We were only looking at a Met Tower and a trail for the Met Tower. So, you know, we did wetland surveys related to the Met Tower trail, which included identifying potential wildlife habitats, including vernal pools, bog lemming habitat, things like that. So, and when during those surveys, which was a limited field survey area related just to the Met Tower and the trail, we didn't identify any potential vernal pools.
Is it not true that at that point you knew that you were planning to put a project on Six Mountain?
Oh, sure, but you know, the first thing you do is put up a Met Tower. You don't create a layout for a project based on pure topography. And at that point, it's like prospecting.
Isn't it true that that since there is a limited window for studying vernal pools, that should be planned for?
Correct. However, there's no way we could have known where to survey and to focus our surveys into areas that are potentially affected by a proposed project. All we were looking at that early stage was a Met Tower and a trail.
But then by knowing that you have to make a third quarter 2010 deadline for stimulus money, how would you expect to do a correct vernal pool survey?
Well, the fact of the matter is we did do a correct vernal pool survey. We were outside of the window to have pools that we found certified as significant.
You only could survey and come up with potential pools, not real pools. And since vernal pools are a special sensitive ecological situation, one would have thought differently.
Well, by identifying a potential pool, what you're looking for is areas that contain tadpoles, salamander larvae, and also areas of standing water that are potential breeding areas. So you inevitably include natural and man-made features.
But you did not, it's not true that you did not do a full vernal pool survey to actually verify where vernal pools are on Six Mountain in the footprint of the turbines.
No, we did. That's what I'm saying. We did the surveys, and there is an approved protocol for doing it outside of the window where you certify significance.
Let's move on. Right.
Okay, just one last question. John Titus. In evaluating the impacts of the project, was the impact of light pollution from the turbines on the dark night sky in more remote areas such as Bigelow considered in that determination?
No. No, in fact, at the time the plan was in formation, we weren't considering wind power projects at all in terms of those potential impacts. They weren't in the mix during that time period.
So the impact of light pollution was not figured in any of these?
It wasn't factored in any of the discussions at that time that I'm aware of. I mean, as far as I went with the process, there may have been some discussion of it outside of my participation, but I'm not aware of any.
Okay. That's all from me.
I'd like to ask Ms. Visering a question. In your aesthetic and scenic analysis, did you take into account red lights at the campsite on the Horns in Bigelow?
Our study area was an 8-mile radius, and so no, we did not.
Are you aware that campers now at the Horns and other parts of the Bigelow Preserve are confronted with red lights at night?
At the present time?
Yes, right now.
Oh, because from the Kibbe Project?
Correct.
Yes.
Are you aware of that?
Am I aware of it?
Yes.
I guess I'm not surprised. Because when we did the Kibbe Project, we did a 15-mile radius for that project. So, we were aware that there would be visibility there.
And did you do any studies in terms of potential lights on Sist Mountain and where that would be impacted?
I'm trying to remember what I said in my report, but it was definitely something that I considered in my assessment.
And did you find any place where it, as to where it would be visible?
There will be lights visible in the generally in the areas.
Can you tell us where, please?
In the areas that are shown on the viewshed analysis, wherever there is potential visibility, there are likely to be lights that will be visible.
Was the visibility of lights from the Kibbe Project considered in your analysis of the Kibbe Project?
Could you repeat that question?
Yes. Was the potential of lights being seen by campers at night on Bigelow or other places considered in your Kibbe study?
I don't remember getting, because of the distance, in fact, I think that Bigelow, except for Cranberry Mountain, was beyond the 15-mile radius that we looked at in that case. So I don't think we went into detail in that regard.
But you are aware that people who would be camping at the Horns, which is a major campsite in a highly wilderness area, would be able to be impacted by the lights of the turbine.
I'm assuming that the lights at that distance would be quite faint, but yes, I'm sure they are visible.
Are you aware that they go on and off all night?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Maybe a little bit. Let's. I think the next is redirect by TransCanada. Okay, and that's 10 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Anderson for TransCanada. I just have a couple of quick questions for Peter Vickery. Peter, I just want to make sure you have reviewed the application and are familiar with the impacts to Bicknell's thrush habitat on the ridgelined area of the project footprint, correct?
Correct.
And by that we mean that you're aware of the eight, I'm sorry? Yeah, sorry. And that you're aware of the fact that there will be 8 acres of impacts to the 88 acres of Bicknell's thrush habitat that's been mapped, as well as approximately 39 acres of direct impacts to the subalpine fir forest.
Excuse
in the project
me,
footprint, correct?
I object. I didn't ask Dr. Vickery about the 8 acres of direct.
Well, there was some discussion both in questions from the commission and on cross. It had to do with the impacts on the ridgeline and the use of regenerating fir forest. So these questions really go to that issue. I think they're responsive to that. Your conclusion that this project will not result in an undue adverse effect on Bicknell's thrush, even if we set aside the potential habitat for regenerating clear cuts, your position is that the impacts on the ridgeline are still not significant. Well, this is on redirect, so I'm just trying to make sure that I've focused Mr. Vickery on responding to some of the questions that came up from the commission and from cross-examination.
Maybe we did hear the question. What's the question?
So the question is that even if we don't consider regenerating fir forests in the area, Mr. Vickery, your conclusion is still that the impacts on the ridgeline are not significant, correct?
That's absolutely, whoopsie. Yes, that's completely correct, that this the loss of 8 acres is equivalent to the approximately one home range of one female, and that's of no consequence.
And you've also, there was testimony, though, about the use of regenerating fir forest, and would you agree that if you're going to evaluate the impacts of this project, you do need to take into consideration?
I think this is a fair objection. Redirect is not an opportunity to ask leading questions. It's an opportunity to ask questions of your witnesses.
Okay. Well, I guess I just want to make sure that I understand that, Mr. Vickery, when you look at the impacts of this project and you're trying to evaluate the habitat, what do you need to consider in the area when you're trying to reach that kind of a conclusion?
Well, from my point of view, it's certainly a landscape issue, and that, I mean, I know the project is limited to a relatively small footprint, and from Bicknell's Thrush point of view, 8 acres of loss of habitat. But really, the issue is one of a landscape scale, other mountaintops where it breeds, and the forest use in the area is clearly having an effect on the population in this region.
And just one other question. You had gotten a question from the commission about the fact that you hadn't had any published works here. There's some information in your direct testimony about your experience with Bicknells. I think it would be important just to remind the commission and the parties of some of the work that you've done and the survey work that you've done. I think it's on page 2 of your testimony in order to fully respond to the question.
Well, it was so long ago. But I know that I started in the mid-1970s, having hiked and been around Mount Katahdin looking at thrushes in that area, having led actually a number of Maine Audubon field trips to Baxter as part of the Maine Breeding Bird Atlas Survey in the late 70s and 80s. I surveyed a number of mountain peaks, including Mount Blue, Grafton Notch, Baldpate. I've surveyed areas up near Rangeley, West Kennebago Mountain. I've been to areas looking for Bicknell's thrush on coastal Washington County. I'm planning to go up again to another mountain site this summer, specifically with this issue in mind. And I've been to the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and Cuba, where this bird winters, and tried to gain insight into what the issues are for Bicknell's thrush in winter.
Great, thanks very much.
Thank you, Juliette Brown. Mr. Titus, I have a question for you. You were asked by Ms. Johnson about your work at BPL and background work on preparation of the inventory process for the management plan in that area. Can you describe for the commission the body of data that you're familiar with, either through that inventory process or otherwise, that provides you information on the nature of the use that occurs in chain of ponds?
Sure. Each of the resource managers working for the Bureau or in conjunction with the Bureau, which would have included the Maine Natural Areas Program, were responsible for inventorying their specific resource area for natural resources and ecology. So we had natural resource inventory work done by MNAP. Historic site specialists provided us with a report, which of course included information about the Arnold Trail and the general usage, historic usage of the Chain of Ponds area. We had a recreation survey done, which was mostly by the regional management staff that had a lot of history with the area in regards to the existing uses. Our wildlife specialist provided information on habitat-related resources throughout the plan area. And all of this, and then, of course, my work in terms of the administrative issues was to get information on the existing leases and other administrative issues that may be present on the unit. And so we took all of this and collectively put it together and came up with the scoping or pre-plan document that Ms. Johnson referred to.
Great, thank you. And either you or Ms. Visserin can answer this question, but she also, Ms. Johnson also commented on primitive campsites in the Chain of Ponds unit. And are there any views of the project from those campsites?
In our estimation, there would not be. And one of the things about qualifying the term primitive campsite, these are all drive-to campsites that have very primitive facilities attached to them, all on the shoreline, and this is where the recreational use is concentrated, is on the shoreline, and in our estimation, there would be no project view from those use areas.
Thank you. And at the risk of potential future further confusion, Mr. Velu, on the question about surveys for vernal pools, could you help explain for the commission the difference between identifying a potential vernal pool and determining whether a vernal pool is significant for regulatory purposes?
Sure. Any vernal pool survey would include identifying all potential pools. In order to determine significance under the Natural Resources Protection Act and what the state regulates for significant pools, it needs to be a natural feature that has certain numbers of use by different species of amphibians, such as wood frogs, spotted salamanders, blue spotted salamanders, and fairy shrimp.
And just in the interest of time, I'm going to interrupt you and ask, is the time frame for determining significance is in the spring, is that right?
Correct.
And can you determine the existence of a potential vernal pool outside of that window?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then in the last minute remaining, Mr. Bennett, because this question has come up on several occasions and I think there's oftentimes confusion, could you explain for the commission the concept of installed capacity and capacity factor and estimates on total megawatt hours of generation, because I think it would be helpful for everybody to work off of the same assumptions and understanding.
Sure. If we're talking about the Kibbe project itself, so it has a capacity in megawatts of 132 megawatts, right? That's based on the 66 machines, the full project. Based on that, we projected a total production of 356,000 megawatt hours per year of energy production. So that's energy versus capacity is the distinction there. That 356,000 megawatt hours translates into a capacity factor of about 30.6%. So it's just, you know, how often the machine runs versus like 100% of the time, or at 100% of the time at 100% output. For CISC, the capacity is 45 megawatts. We're projecting a energy production of that of 120,000 megawatt hours, which again is 30.4% capacity factor, pretty much in line with what the Kibbe project is. When we looked at the production for the Kibbe project for phase one and excluded the time where we deliberately took the farm offline for collector system issues, it has run at about something over 29% capacity factor. So that 29.2 compared to the 30.6% we were expecting, you know, longer term is, you know, in the ballpark. And we should always caveat that it's a very, very short period of time. We're talking about, you know, a few months here, but it's in line with what we would expect for the project at this point of time.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Thank you very much. I just want to ask a question. There's been reference made to the 2007 Flagstaff Regional Management Plan. Is that in the record? Has it been? It isn't.
No, I believe so. I submitted a portion of the plan. I believe Plans Canada submitted the whole plan. Can we just have
staff? I guess I just want the staff to assure that it is in there. And that
if it isn't, we'd be happy to.
Yeah, and we have access to that. Okay, thank you. And I guess we're going to take lunch now. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to come back around and...
Yes. Can you hear me now? The issue of the photos that Gwen set aside Juliet, I had a chance to look at the pictures, and they were attached to what you've identified as TransCanada Exhibit 4. I can't figure out what that links up to. Some of your exhibits have been numbered.
You're not the only one.
Okay.
What I was going to do was identify the exhibits that I would like to move into the record. They're not numbered sequentially because there was additional exhibits that we thought might come in through redirect that didn't come up. So,
The only way the exhibits have been entered into this record is by attachment to direct testimony. So they haven't been numbered for purposes of this hearing, is my understanding. So what would be helpful to me, I guess, for the rest of the hearing is if any of the parties have exhibits that were not pre-filed, if they could distribute those separately and bring it to Gwen's attention beforehand. And these were sandwiched in with other things that I'm assuming were attached to the pre-filed testimony. So I've had a chance to take a look at them, and my recommendation, Gwen, is that they appear to be general photographs, not in direct response to direct testimony. And my recommendation is that they would not be that helpful. The Commission's aware of the general conditions of the site, and that I would strike them because they were not pre-filed. We'll go with that then.
Could I just respond to this issue generally, because it may come up through the rest of the day? First of all, the photographs are from the site, not where the Commission went yesterday. So the Commission hasn't actually seen that subalpine community. But the other broader question was, I was going to move the PowerPoint presentations into the record as evidence. You could certainly exclude the two photographs, but would like to have the PowerPoint presentations themselves in the record. There's one further exhibit that I was going to hand out now. Attached to Dr. Hudson's PowerPoint was an excerpt from a state document, the Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy, and I was just going to provide the more complete but not the total document, a version that shows the cover page. This is a document that was cited in Dr. Publicover's pre-file testimony, but I'd like to have the actual document in the record. So we've pre-numbered that 5. So what I was going to propose is that we move in Exhibits 1, 4, 6, and 19, which are the PowerPoint presentations, and Exhibit 5, which is the excerpt from the IF&W Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy.
Any objection?
During the break and respond after the break. Is that possible?
That's fair. Take a look at them.
Okay.
Good. Thanks. So let's break for lunch and be back here at 1:30. We're behind, I think Catherine said, about 40 minutes. We'll see you at 1:30.